We're having another great talk again, hopefully. I'm sure it will be, with a person who has been working on the internet for quite a while. Actually, this year he celebrates his 10th anniversary on running one of the major, well, it's a tool actually, but you could also call it a platform. We're getting into that a little bit later, but he's been running that. He co-founded it. It's called Moz now. It used to be SEO Moz. He's a person that many people in, especially in the industry and when it comes to search, know, but who does so much more. And I'm really looking forward to talking to him, Mr. Ran Fishkin. Hello, Ran. How are you doing?
Yes, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for taking the time to do this. I'm just peeking behind you and seeing the Hawks there. Is that
Oh yeah, that's
you are from Seattle, right? So
that's
that's.
right. Seattle. So this is a Seattle Seahawks blanket that my wife has had since I think 1982, and you might be aware, but Seattle hadn't had a major professional sports championship for many decades until the Seahawks won the Super Bowl. Actually, there's one exception to that. We did have a WNBA, the Women's NBA Championship, but it was very exciting for us, and so I have the blanket there.
Are you a fan?
I am. The Seahawks aren't actually my favorite team. They're my second favorite team, but I certainly enjoy the energy that the city had around that run up to the win.
It's an interesting thing as well, like sports and when you talk about marketing, that's
Oh yeah.
wow, sports is like the place to do marketing, right? Have you ever done any work within that industry?
I haven't, well, not formally anyway. I have, some friends who've done marketing for the NFL. I actually pitched, back when I was a consultant, I pitched the New York Jets organization, the Jets football team out in New York. I remember going to their headquarters in Manhattan, and it ended up not working out. They decided not to do an SEO engagement, but it was pretty fascinating to hear sort of their challenges and the intricacies around that. And then one of the other odd coincidences is Seattle has a professional soccer team, or what everyone in the world except Americans would call football team. And the general manager of that football team, Adrian Hanauer, is actually an investor in Moz. He was one of our first
Oh,
investors
really?
back in 2007. And so occasionally he'll get us free tickets to a game and that sort of thing.
So there is a connection somewhere.
Yes.
Let's get into a little bit of introduction on you for those that might not know you as well as most people within the search industry do know you. You do a lot of different things. So I mentioned Moz. You're a speaker. You travel the world a lot, discussing digital marketing. You're very active on different platforms, which I want to get into a little bit later as well. What is your main job role at the moment? What will you call yourself?
Yeah, so previously, for most of Moz's life as a software company from 2007 until about 3 months ago, I was our CEO and obviously the founder. But in January, I actually changed roles to become an individual contributor, meaning that I essentially don't have people reporting to me, with the exception of my assistant Nikki, and I don't generally deal with people or management or organizational development and process issues. But I am getting to do a lot more of the stuff that I love around product development, product research, as well as marketing, evangelism, and my own sort of private kinds of research. So, yeah, we might talk about the iMac lab that I just
Definitely,
launched around testing.
yes.
Some of these experiments that I've been able to run recently. And as you mentioned, obviously, I'm traveling and speaking a lot, getting to spend a lot more time with marketers out in the field, and a little bit less time with sort of, HR issues internally or finance and board-related types of things. And that's nice. It's
So
very nice.
you've actually reached a point which many people want to reach, which is, okay, you've built your business, it's doing well, and now you get to step back and actually do the fun stuff again.
Yeah, I'm hopeful. Well, so there's a few complexities around that, right? So Moz has actually had kind of a difficult 9 to 12 months, I would say. I think in a lot of areas where we have built our software, we sort of spread ourselves pretty thin over the last few years, right? We invested in, I don't know, let's say there's a dozen things that kind of Moz's platform or tools do. And I would say of those, there's probably 6 to 8 where we've had an individual competitor who just does that one thing kind of surpass us in the field. And I think now we have to kind of trim down, focus, play catch up, and decide where we really want to concentrate. And part of that is the work that I'm doing right now, working with our product teams and R&D to try and figure that out and get back to a place where, you know, we can truly have a best-in-class product across all the things that we do. And maybe that means doing a few less things and focusing. And then, of course, I do get to do a lot of the marketing and evangelism stuff, which I love and I've always loved. And I get to go back into the trenches. You know, I'm back to doing some SEO stuff and testing my anchor text and seeing if I can influence search suggest. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah. So focus is the key word in your work now, or at least in the last couple of months. What's the focus of Moz at the moment?
Yeah, so I think, you know, for a little while we were sort of thinking that, okay, we've done a great job with SEO software, and now we're going to help people with content marketing and social media marketing and maybe brand marketing and this very broad set of things. And I think we've decided that we're going to concentrate a little bit more on back to not just exclusively SEO, but SEO and things that SEOs need, like the social media bits that are really important to SEOs, the content marketing bits that are really important to SEOs, the local bits that are really important to SEOs. And you can see our product, Moz Local, which is actually a product I'm very proud of. I think David Mim did a great job with that. And that's sort of going to be our focus, I think, for at least the next year or two. And then you might see us try and expand again, but probably a little more slowly into new fields rather than, 5 to 10 things all at once.
Would you say this is like taking one step back to take 2 steps forward?
Well, I mean, knock on wood, right?
Yeah.
Eventually.
That's
eventually,
the intention.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you changed the name from SEO Moz to Moz. Can you tell us a little bit about why you did that?
Yeah, so that was, almost exactly a year ago now that we did that. And that change was really predicated on a few different things. One was we wanted to help people do things that were beyond just SEO. We already had things in our software, FollowerWonk, right, which is an acquisition we made, or Freshweb Explorer, right, which really competes more with something like Google Alerts mm-hmm. than it does with any particular SEO tool. And those kinds of things were a little awkward sitting under a brand name that had SEO in its title. And we felt that in order to expand our product line and do the things that we wanted to do, we needed a bigger, broader name. It's also the case that Moz was available. It's a 3-letter domain name. It's just a great brand, right? It's something that is actually pronounceable for a lot of folks, as opposed to, outside of our industry, people who don't know the acronym SEO could not say what our name was, right? They're Xiao Moz, Xiao Moz, CO Moz. I got all sorts of weird things.
Yeah.
So from a branding perspective, I think it was wise. And then one of the other weird things that I'm guessing some people in our industry have felt too is that, the reputation that SEO carries outside of the digital marketing fields is not a good one.
Yeah.
And in particular, in the world of technology, so we have 84, 85 software engineers on staff, and, nearly half of them have been hired in the last 12 to 18 months. But hiring software engineers, recruiting software engineers, when your name is SEO Moz, is tremendously challenging because there's a natural negative association in connotation with SEO, especially in those folks' mind. And so we were seeing that, we were sort of losing at the top of the funnel attracting that talent.
Is that changing, you think, now that people are looking differently at SEO, or is that still the same?
I think it depends. I have seen it get a little bit better probably over the past year or two. I think it was much worse, say, 4 or 5 years ago than it is today. And some of that, to be fair, actually is, I think we have Google to thank. They've kind of made their engine not impossible to game, but much more challenging. Mm-hmm. And so you have far fewer people who are doing those really sketchy things in SEO. It's only the truly remarkably talented black hats who can still make a go with that kind of thing. Yeah. And because of that, the field is getting a little cleaner, a little more white hat, a little more accessible to folks who aren't necessarily interested in those gaming and manipulation techniques. And so I'm hopeful that you know, another 4 or 5 years from now, we'll be a lot more like email marketing, which still has some, you know, some people are creeped out about email spam and that kind of thing, but certainly a much more positive association in the vast majority of marketers and technologists' minds.
There's also people who would say the opposite of what you're saying, as in Google is to blame for how SEOs are perceived.
I absolutely agree with that. So, you know, from 1997 to 2009, 10 at the least, I would say Google's lack of concentration on web spam, on manipulation, on tactics made it such that you had the rise of this, you know, sort of underbelly of our industry. And I'm fascinated by that underbelly, and I have plenty of friends who to this day are still web spammers, but I do think, you know, that's a problem of Google's own creation, and they know that.
So how do you think all the penalties which are being discussed widely, maybe it's not even the fact that they are being given, but the fact that they're being discussed, what do you think that does for SEO in general?
Gosh, you know, it's a little challenging. I think in some ways it can help send a message that Google wants to send, right? Which is that we would prefer people didn't do this. But at the same time, a lot of the ones that receive mainstream coverage get, you know, cleaned up and forgiven so quickly, particularly in the case of big brands that, you know, are written about outside of the pure SEO and digital marketing fields. You know, RapGenius being a recent example, of course, but there's plenty of historic ones of big brands as well. And I think when those get fixed within a week or two and Google sort of forgives and forgets almost instantaneously, I almost wonder if that does more harm than good from a branding and messaging perspective on their, you know, from their perspective. I worry that, you know, people look and go, well, I guess if we spam, worst case, we'll only be banned for a week. That's fine. We can handle it.
Yep. So if you look at, you've been in the industry for quite a bit. If you look at all the different channels, so you mentioned email, we have SEO, you've got content marketing, which is now actually more or less integrated with SEO. Where do you put SEO in all of the digital landscape?
Also, SEO is still a massive driver of traffic. You know, I was very impressed by a study that Define Media Group, who works with a number of the huge brands in publishing, did recently. I think it was 2 or 3 months ago that they put together an analysis of, you know, how much traffic is driven by the social media networks versus by search engines. And you can see it's still, you know, massively more traffic, even to those sites that are very social media friendly and get a lot of social sharing activity, they are still getting, you know, 4, 5, 6 times the traffic from search that they get from social. So obviously search is still a huge driver of raw traffic. I would also say, though, that search is always going to be, even if it gets surpassed at some point by some other channel in terms of traffic sent, I believe it will always be the most intentional channel that we have. And because of the intent behind a searcher's, you know, query terms and what they're trying to accomplish as they go through a mission with a search engine, people who can attract that traffic are always going to have, you know, a great opportunity to convert those people, convert those visits. And that's where I think the true power of search still lies.
So there is still a future for search.
Oh my God. It's not going anywhere. Not for a long time.
So it's still going to be important. How do you feel that if you work with clients and if you talk to marketers, as you said, you've been traveling a lot where you speak to marketers and actual marketers who are in the field.
Yeah.
How do you feel they perceive the position of search? So are a few years back, or even I think maybe 5 years back, 6 years back, it was always at the back of the line. So somebody built a website, and then once everything was done, oh, wait a minute, we have to do search as well.
Right.
How do you feel that is now?
I would say search and SEO is getting a little bit more respect in the digital marketing stack and from, you know, CMOs and marketing departments, as well as those who contract agencies and consultants. Certainly, there is more knowledge about that. And I think we're also seeing kind of a slow but eventual generational shift, right? The CMOs and the heads of marketing today are folks who didn't necessarily grow up in what we'd call the internet age, but at least in the digital age, right? They had computers as kids. They, you know, they were on the web in the 1990s. And so I think that that generational transition, along with just a lot more competition in the space and a lot more realization and public discussion about the power of being in search engines, having a social media presence, getting a great email marketing list. I think because those things are getting to some level of maturity in the marketing space, we're seeing companies invest a lot more.
So part of maturing is understanding what you're doing. Is understanding your
well, audience. It depends. If you ask a teenager, they're going to tell you otherwise.
Well, they're going to say, yes, you're right, 10 years after, right? but understanding is important. So measurement, understanding the audience. One of the things you said you were doing now is that you're paying a lot more attention to testing. So yes. One of the things you just launched, actually, this week or last week, it's the iMac Lab. Could you tell us a little bit about what that is?
Yeah, so iMac Lab is a personal project that's sort of inside of Moz, but it's basically just me running it right now. And the idea was, you know, I'd been getting together some friends and colleagues from around the industry and running a few tests. So I wanted to see, you know, does sharing something on Twitter get it indexed faster than just putting it in the sitemap alone? Does sharing it on Google+ does sharing on Google+ have any impact on rankings, short term, long term, medium term? We tested some things around anchor text. You know, I was at a bar at a conference in February, and a colleague, a friend of mine from the space, said, "Hey, Rand, I think anchor text might not be doing much of anything at all. You know, I'm seeing that the links that we're getting, you know, it's not really showing anything." And so we ran a bunch of tests. You know, we basically ran three tests where we put together kind of scenarios and pointed anchor text and non-anchor text from the same page to two different pages that were ranking, and then saw them, watch the movement over time. And, you know, you discover fascinating things. We found a few fascinating things from that experiment that we didn't even expect to find. And, you know, as I was going through this process, I got to thinking, man, this is very enjoyable for me, right? This is something I take a lot of personal pride and pleasure in. And it's also really rewarding for the field, because I think that we can, there's just a tremendous amount we can learn from it. Knowledge won't be perfect, and there'll always be caveats. But I wanted to do it at greater scale. And so I put together this project called IMEC. It's an acronym, stands for Internet Marketing Experimental Collective.
And so it's IMEC, so not IMEC as in computer, but IMEC, yes.
Right. IMEC, not yes. IMAC. You know, so far we've had 250 people apply and basically say that they'd be willing to use their social media accounts and their websites as places, as test beds to help us run these kinds of experiments. And that's, you know, that's pretty powerful. I think that can really help us learn a lot. So I'm excited to build the board for this project. I have a few volunteers to join a board to help design the experiments and measure the results, keep track of things. And then, you know, I'm hoping we can form some hypotheses, build some experiments that will validate those hypotheses, and then repeat the tests multiple times so that we can have some real confidence that the results are consistent and that we really understand how, you know, some particular social platform or search engine's working.
How would you validate the data in that? So basically, if people sign up for that, you might end up having all the same sort of people in your database. How do you manage that?
I'm not terribly concerned if many of those people are, you know, from the web marketing and internet marketing field. I'm much more interested in sort of the diversity of websites and accounts that we've got. So, for example, let's say we wanted to test something like the reach of a Facebook post scale directly with the quantity of likes it receives, or are there limitations around that? Like, it, you know, it, it's much more controlled, so that, you know, if a tight group of people sees something, it's much less likely to spread, as opposed to a broad group of people clicking that like button, making it more likely to spread. And so we've got, you know, we've got a nice group of folks. We can see how they're connected to each other on Facebook. We can have them all, you know, test like a post and see what the reach goes to. And we can repeat that experiment several times. And if we see the same results over and over again, we can feel confident that we've learned something from that.
So who would benefit from this?
I think it's really marketers who benefit. But that being said, I actually also think it's the networks themselves who benefit from this. I know that there are people inside Google who would say, you know, making our rankings or indexation or spam or whatever systems more transparent exposes us to risk, but I actually think it makes them less exposed to risk over the long term. And I think it's the right thing for them and for the field. I think there's a reason that Larry and Sergey had transparency as a core value at Google, because, you know, security through obscurity is a terrible thing, and having all these secrets is just not useful. And I think for a lot of, not just hardcore marketers, right, because we're the kind of people who could figure this stuff out on our own potentially and learn, but for a ton of people who are entering the field or who are small business owners, medium business owners, marketers who just have no time to investigate how the nuts and bolts of SEO or social media might work, this kind of thing is invaluable to them, right? Having someone who does this research and can say, hey, this is how this works, and then maybe someone from one of these networks can validate that or claim it's not the case and then explain why the results were the way they are.
So for example, if a company thinks, okay, we have this product which we want to launch, and then what happens a lot is that they think, so what channels shall we pick? And then they just pick one or two. Based on your research, they can actually pick one which makes sense?
Maybe a little bit of that, but even more so, I think it might be deeper in the tactical level. So they say to themselves, hey, you know, we think we've got an audience of this size on Facebook. If we can get 10% of them to interact with our post, we can reach this many people. And what I'm hoping my research will be able to say is, no, wait, you can actually rely on that number. That, you know, that estimate that you're creating is probably way off. And here's the, you know, here's the different relative levels that we saw in testing, you know, experiments of that size. Or, you know, things like testing that, the anchor text thing, right? So, you know, a lot of SEOs right now are going out and saying, oh, maybe anchor text doesn't matter as much, and so it's not as important to get the link with the anchor text I'm seeking. The experiment we looked at, you know, I'll give you an example. The third experiment in the series that we performed, which I think was one of the most dramatic, we pointed the exact anchor text to a page that was ranking number 31, and the non-exact anchor text, you know, didn't have the keywords in the phrase, to a page that was ranking number 19. And, you know, just about a week after pointing those, when all the links had been indexed, that one at 31 was ranking number one for the keyword phrase, and the one from at 19 had moved up, I think, 11 positions to number 8. So, yes, raw links clearly have some impact, but wow, anchor text still looks quite influential.
So it's something that people can use to, or marketers can use to point their direction, to really pinpoint their direction on which they're heading. And by the sound of it, but correct me if I'm wrong, this could also be very useful to convince CMOs, for example, or your boss. So you're a marketer and you want to convince people within your company to go your direction. You can go and say, wait a minute, this is the results of the tests. Look at this. This is what we're doing.
Yeah. So, for example, you know, they might say, hey, look, it doesn't matter what kind of links we're getting. As long as we're getting some, we're going to be fine. And you can say, actually, it really does matter, which is why I think it's so important that the naming convention for this product line we're launching include these words in it, right? Because you know everybody's going to link to it with the name of the product. And so now you can go to your, you know, from a digital marketer can go to the branding team or the product naming team and say, hey, guys, this is seriously going to matter. It's really going to move the needle on our marketing. And here's some evidence to back that up.
Building bridges. Can people sign up for this? Where can they find this?
Yeah, it's actually, there's a blog post on moz.com/rand, which is my personal blog. just called iMac Lab. And if you read that post, there's a bunch of links to a SurveyMonkey form where you can sign up to join the team. And of course, we'd love to have anyone who'd participate.
Okay, well, if everything's correct, when I've done this video, it will show up like right here. That will be the link to your post. When it comes to digital marketing and when it comes to those people who want to get forward, the ones you're targeting with your research now, for example, you as the experienced digital marketer, what would you say is the starting point for each marketer? Where should they begin?
Well, so I'm actually a big believer in what I like to call the T-shaped model of knowledge in web marketing. So I think that it is, don't get me wrong, extremely valuable to have deep tactical and strategic knowledge and experiential knowledge around a single field, right? So if you say, hey, I'm really passionate about email marketing. I think, subject lines and headlines and testing different forms and learning how to build lists and these kinds of things, that's really where my passion lies. That's great. What I would urge you to do, though, is to get at least a small amount of knowledge in each of the fields that a digital marketer touches these days, right? So if you're an SEO, get some knowledge about paid search and about email marketing and about branding and about information architecture and user experience. All of these things will help you to be better at your job, and they're really going to help you when you have to work cross-functionally. Mm. I think this is one of the lessons that I've that's been really ingrained in me over the last 5 years in SEO, is that SEO can't operate well in a silo anymore. If you want to be great at SEO, you have to, for example, as we were just talking about, you have to be able to work with your product team and your branding team to be able to get naming conventions right, because that's a huge part of how people are going to search, how they're going to find you.
Yeah.
Same thing goes for an email marketer, right? The best way to build a list is to have an audience that's coming to pages you own and control, and then having those email sign-up forms there. And if you don't understand conversion rate optimization and how to drive traffic to those pages, you can't really be successful at building a great list or a great subscription. And I think this applies kind of universally, which is why I'm such a fan of that T-shaped marketer. So as for where to start, I would try and get those boxes, know what those boxes are that you need to check, and then run down the list, right? How do I learn a little bit about email marketing? Or maybe I can spend a day with our email team. Maybe I can join a webinar. Maybe I can, go to an email marketing event or conference. If I'm in SEO and I want to pick up a paid search, I can spend some time, learning from those resources. I think that's a very smart idea.
I completely 100% agree with you. And I actually also tell this a lot in my training sessions, not exactly the way you say it, but it's the same message. And I sometimes, often actually, get faces which go like, oh, and then they look at their agenda and then they say, where do I get the time to do all that stuff?
Yeah. Well, this is, this is why I like to think of it as kind of T-shaped, right? So you have great depth of knowledge on one particular item, and then across the spectrum, you have much more broad knowledge and not that deep knowledge. So, you spend a day learning the ins and outs of email marketing, that probably is going to last you a good year or two. And if you interact with email teams, over that year or two, you can maintain some of that knowledge. So this is not, I'm not asking people to spend months learning every single practice, but a day or two picking up those key critical ones that touch your areas, I think that's a good way to go.
Yeah. Richard Branson from Virgin, he once said, when asked about how he spends so much time on social, where do you get the time? He said, "I can't afford not to." Would you agree on that?
Yeah, I think that's a great quote.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say I'm similarly built, right? So I have I have my meetings during the day, and I have sort of quiet work hours, in the morning and the evening, and I just, there's rarely a period where I'll have 3 or 4 hours where I'm completely away from social. And the thing is, once you spend a little bit of time on those networks and you get comfortable with them, 5 minutes can be an incredible amount of productivity, right? You can scan through 50 previous tweets and retweet someone who will appreciate that and might help you in the future, and you can reply to a few people who've pinged you, and you can, you know, throw up a URL on Google Plus or on Facebook. This is not a huge time commitment. It just requires sort of initially getting good at it, and then maintaining that discipline of spending those 5 minutes every few hours.
You must know your audience, because you started answering the question before I even asked it, because that was what I was going to get into. because if you look at what you're doing online, especially, like, I'm a big fan of Quora. I get a lot of stuff out of Quora, not just as in answering questions or reading the questions, but also like in understanding what makes people tick. You're on there a lot. You answer a lot of questions on Quora. You do the Whiteboard Fridays. You speak. You write blog posts. Where do you get the time to do that?
So, you know, you mentioned that I do a lot on Quora. I actually would say Quora is one of the networks that I visit least frequently. Maybe once every 2 weeks I go on Quora, answer a few questions. But it does create a perception that I'm on there regularly, right? And over time, you know, if over 52 weeks you go on and you answer three questions every 2 weeks, well, that's 150 answers, right? That's quite substantive, or 75, right? Or 150 over 2 years. And the same thing kind of applies to a lot of places where I contribute. So, for example, conferences and events, you know, I do travel a lot. I'm on the road almost 100 days a year. And that is something where I invest tremendously. But those events turn into, make everything else that I do much easier. For example, growing my social following is fairly simple, because I speak at so many events, I get exposed to so many people, and they help, you know, spread and amplify that message. I put my presentations on SlideShare, which then gets me a lot more traffic, right? That day at the event, there's 200, 300, 400 people who've sent tweets with the URL of my slide deck, which means thousands of people are going to see it. And that amplification makes, you know, nearly every event that I go to worth 5 or 10 times what it would have been, because those SlideShares have, you know, URLs embedded in them, and people click those URLs and they go check out the tools that I mentioned or the blog posts that I'm referencing. And some of those people become Moz customers. This, you know, this applies too from a knowledge perspective. It's really easy for me to get in the whiteboard room, draw up a Whiteboard Friday, and make that presentation in, say, 45 minutes or so for a 10-minute talk, because I've had 20 conversations over the last 2 weeks all about some topic that, you know, that keeps coming up and that's really important. And so I can sort of internalize that and then put it on the whiteboard. I'm not searching for a topic.
Right. When it comes to SlideShare, by the way, aren't you afraid of repetition? So that there must be overlap within your talks?
Sometimes, yeah.
You're not afraid that people see the same deck on SlideShare all the time?
Not particularly. And I would say that I usually will deliver a slide deck maybe 2 to 4 times publicly. And usually it tends to reach different audiences each time, right? So the people who are following the conversion rate optimization heavy crowd that I spoke to at Opticon last week is very different from the SEO-focused crowd who I gave the same talk to 3 weeks prior at SearchLove in Boston, right? And so they're amplifying to different groups, meaning different people are seeing this. And if there's overlap, I think people are pretty understanding that, you know, I can't create a new presentation for every single talk, given how frequently I do them.
Yeah. So this helps building a community as well. So in the last part of this talk, I wanted a little bit getting to understand or have people understand how you build Moz to such a big brand what it is now, which is, it's a big community where people are very loyal to.
And very active.
And very active, yes. That takes a lot of effort.
Yeah, I think it's a, you know, it comes from a place of having kind of deep empathy and caring for the audience, even prior to this idea of wanting to build a brand and wanting to build a community, right? So, you know, the first few people who commented on Moz, like, I still love and appreciate their effort to this day, right? And it's still tremendously meaningful to me. And I think that because we share the community there shares both a passion but also has a great incentive to contribute knowledge to one another and to learn. And people there observe the reciprocation that other members provide. And our community team does, you know, a very good job of kind of, I would say, guiding and shaping behavior, right? So they, you know, they're very, very cautious about what we call broken windows theory in the community. And broken windows, I mean, you know, sort of if something looks amiss, right? People have left spammy comments, people have been rude or you know, mean to each other. We'll jump on that right away, try and get rid of that stuff.
So it means being very active and responsive to what's going on as a community team.
Yes.
Is that the holy grail for creating a community?
I would say it's the holy grail once you've built an initial core community, right? Once you've built it and you're trying to grow it, scale it, and manage it at that scale, that's where that careful management and that broken windows cleanup, it comes in real handy. I think in order, building a community is much more challenging. I think Moz benefited tremendously from being an early mover in the space, right? Okay. Because we were one of the first, you know, major blogs in the industry, and because we were putting out, you know, content that at the time, you know, now would probably be considered fairly run-of-the-mill or even not that great, but at the time was, you know, some of the best stuff you could find on the web around those topics, I think that really helped benefited us. And so this is, you know, early mover advantage is a big thing in marketing.
But then again, if you look at the early movers, many have gone, and you're still there.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. I mean, this is for us, it's a marathon, not a sprint, right?
Yeah. So, if you look at the community, when it comes to Moz, and I'm quite curious if you agree with me on this. If I look at it from a relatively outsider from the community, because if I look at it, it kind of feels like a group of college people together, as in you are friends for life when you go to college. You can miss out on them for 4 or 5 years, then meet up with them again, and it's like old days again. That kind of feels the same if I look at your community. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, actually, I really think I do. You know, I saw someone that I haven't seen in a long time commented on a recent blog post of mine. It was Mikkel Demib.
Yeah.
And you know, Mikkel, I've known, gosh, since I got into the industry. Probably, I think I saw him my first or second conference, right, in 2004. And, you know, he's always been just this amazing character and personality. And seeing him on the blog again, you know, just brought back all these feelings of camaraderie and, you know, of trying to learn how the engines are working again. And, reminded me why I felt such a kinship with him in those early days. He gave me great advice back when I was a consultant too about the prices that we were charging and the rates and these kinds of things. So yeah, I completely agree. You can, you know, maybe I think it might've been 3 years since he last commented on the blog.
Yeah.
And there he is. And you're right. It's back to old days.
Yeah. He's been around though. I've spent some time with him in Iran actually last year. So that was very impressive as well. So one of the things we can conclude then is if you want to build a community, try and get that same feeling and look at college people and how they interact, and maybe you can copy that in a way.
Yeah, I think if you can build those core connections with even just a few dozen people, that camaraderie, that attitude, and that amplification, that will spread. It'll spread to the rest of the community that you built.
Great. So my final question is actually quite simple. If people want to follow you, what's the best channel to follow you on? Where can they find you?
So I would say for me, it's Twitter and my personal blog. So moz.com/rand is my personal blog, and Twitter, I'm @randfish.
And that will also be right below here and in the blog post as well. Thank you, Rand, for taking the time. It's been very, very much enjoyable, as I hoped and expected. And I think we've learned a lot. So thank you very much.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.